Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Westcott on behalf of objector appellants Lewis Frost and Richard Denny. 69-0. 69 different courts across this country have recognized Mr. Todd Hilsey as an expert in the field of class action notice. Zero have accepted the settling party's purported notice expert, Mr. Stephen Weisbrot.
But he didn't testify in this case, right?
He presented evidence regarding the REACH statistics.
But he didn't testify, right?
His evidence was relied upon in the court's determination as far as the reasonableness of the notice.
Go ahead.
What it boils down to was
a
question.
Tell me why I'm confused about that. I thought he didn't testify.
His statistics were what the court relied upon.
Okay,
he did not. I don't think he personally stood up and testified, but it was his declarations that were relied upon. What it boils down to is a question of whether it is okay to approve a class settlement where the claims rate is just so appallingly low. The claims rate here is 0.29%.
Now, counsel, is it growing all the time? I read your briefs, and every time I read your briefs, even your brief, it grows a little bit. Is it still growing?
I think slightly. We're still under half of 1%.
Yeah, but up to 29,000 is the last number I saw. Is that where it is?
I think that's where it is as it stands right now. I don't have the updated numbers from settling parties, vendors, but the last...
How long can it keep growing?
Until the claims close.
Well, and when's that? Is there a date?
I believe there's an 18-month period.
When does that date period end? That's what I'm after.
I don't think it starts until this is resolved.
Okay, so boy, this is a long time in the future. These can keep coming in.
They are trickling in.
Your trickle point, but I was confused about that too. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. How was the denominator determined?
This is the number that was provided by Remington as far as the universe of rifles that would be covered under the settlement.
Their sales records for how many decades?
I don't know the exact number, but it's the number that they
60 years
they provided a number of 7.5 to 8 million. When we provide this claims rate number, we're using the lower number.
But it's a fictional. It's a max. Absolutely unreliable as an accurate denominator.
It's the number that Remington himself provided.
It'd be the best number we've got, but that's nothing unusual. The government deals with that kind of.
Right. I mean,
they provided
the range of 7.5 to 8 million.
This is a 50 or 60 year period,
but this
right?
is sales, for, right. sales for gross sales, gross quantity for 50 or 60 years.
Yes.
And so 7.5 million assumes none of them have been lost, none of them have been destroyed, none of them have been thrown away.
I mean, Remington.
Made into assault. Well, we won't go there. Go ahead.
I mean, they themselves advertise these guns as multi-generational. So there's no evidence in the record to suggest that these are in a trash heap.
Of course they do. But
that's one reason they won't come forward, because they're multi-generational. Go ahead.
Because the claims rate is 0.29%, one-third of 1% of the class here, regardless of whether it's 7.5 million or something less, only one-third of 1% is going to receive the benefit of this settlement. And we're not asking the court to overturn the settlement solely on the basis of this appallingly low claims rate, because there could be circumstances.
What's your best case for disapproving a settlement based on claims rate?
I was just saying we're not asking you just to disapprove the settlement on the basis of the claims rate, because there are cases cited where a 1% or a 2% claims rate has been found to be acceptable.
What's your best case on the issue of claim? Your position on claims rate, which frankly I'm very skeptical of.
Well, we're not asking the court to solely look at the claims
That's
rate.
That's where you started. Why can't I ask you for your best case and your lead argument?
The point I'm trying to make here is that there are cases that we have cited and that appellees have cited where a 1% claims rate is acceptable, but this case is distinguishable from those. There are two critical...
So you want us to break new ground on the claims rate issue?
Well, we don't want you to... We're not asking for a ruling stating that the 0.29 claims rate is the reason why this should be overruled. That's not the sole basis. The problem here is that... the notice did not reach the class. There was no actual desire to inform the class. There are major problems with this notice. This case is distinguishable from those cases where there's a 1%.
So the district court was just going through the motions.
They were going through the motions.
Well, now, the district court, I said, the judge,
they were
who
going,
made tremendous personal effort to him to improve the process to the point where he was satisfied it was the best reasonable.
There are several problems with the facts that he accepted as truths, and one of those being that Remington has warranty card data. It's in the record, or the actual warranty card itself is in the record. It has the physical mailing address for individuals who purchase these guns, the model numbers.
So what?
If they have the physical addresses under Mullane and Eisen versus Carlisle, they're required to use the physical addresses, and they did not. They chose not to.
Even if they're from 1957, right? Is that your position?
Mullane?
No.
Oh.
No, even if the card, the warranty card, was sent in 1957.
If they have the address, they need to attempt to use those first, and they just totally disregarded that.
It's a 1957 warranty card.
Yes.
One of these models was 1957,
yes.
As you know. Yeah, right.
They should have first gone to the best, what is well-known and from notice experts everywhere, that direct mail notice gets the highest rates, and they simply chose to disregard that. And in the district court, in making their decision, relied on the argument of Remington's
those
counsel.
Those experts are probably my age and don't understand social media or the internet any better than I do.
Times
evolve, and there are new ways. The way to do it, to reach particularly young people today, may be completely off the chart in terms of what experts would have said 10 years ago you should do.
And we agree with that. We're not trying to...
All right, well, but that's what the district court was dealing with. Times change, and the law has general principles that have to be adaptable.
They're still required to send the best notice practical.
It has to be an abuse of discretion for us to tinker with what the judge did.
I'd like to point out one major problem that we see is that in accepting the settling parties, vendors... notice plan here, and the notice plan that we argue is not the best practical under the circumstances. One, because they didn't use direct notice. Two, because they used an internet-based notice that is majorly flawed. There's a quote from Remington's notice provider, Matt Gerritsen, at one of the hearings where he says, "We saw this as an opportunity to revolutionize the way in which notice was done in the United States and bring it up to the leading standard, but we recognize it's an innovative approach." This was an experiment. This was the
first
notice
time or the second time? As you know, the district
the
court tried
time.
Once.
This
is
this
the
is
second
the second
time.
Time.
Okay, good.
They're
because you had an experiment the first time, too. So you say there are two experiments.
The first time they only sent out 2,500 direct mail notices to class members, regardless of whether that's 7 million or 5 million. 2,571 people got notice.
No, wait a minute.
Got the direct, first time, the first round.
Direct notice.
Direct notice.
Not direct
you're,
notice.
You're
the first
assuming
time.
All other notices in the world failed with all class members.
Not that they all
well,
failed,
that's the way
but there are
that's
major...
That's the way you're arguing it.
I'm pointing out what was done as far as direct notice the first time. Then when the
direct
when the
notice,
vendors...
Direct notice. Eisen does not require direct notice. I reject that legal argument.
It requires the best practical notice under the circumstances.
There you go.
So...
That does not equal direct notice.
We've pointed out, and pro bono expert Todd Hilsey, who's been recognized by a number of courts as a leading expert in the field of class action notice, has pointed out major flaws with their experimental, their own words, an experimental plan. Lots of experiments fail, and this one did, and they don't have the claims rate to back it up. If you're going to do an experimental notice plan, you need to have a claims rate to back it up to show that that worked. And the court... blindly accepted the notice vendor.
There's a difference between notice received and claim submitted.
Yes.
Which are you arguing it? Which was the failure? You don't have any. No. You don't have any evidence of notice of how many of this mythical 7,500,000 people didn't receive the notice.
What we have is
all you're saying is, well, these idiots didn't submit, didn't put in for. Some rifle repair or reimbursement that they could have, and so they can't be stupid, so they must not have gotten the notice. I don't say that A plus B equals C.
we're raising an issue with whether or not the class actually was given the opportunity to be informed. And there are so many problems with this digital experimental plan. They're saying that 40 million were reached, and they're using that as their number. But the court ignored all of the...
Where'd the 40 million come from?
40 million impressions from the internet advertising.
Well, of course, that's not a... It's not a person... 40 million... Okay.
But really, here's what I... where I struggle a little bit is that your argument is that we look at the claims rate and that proves that notice was not received. And yet I look at this thing and I say, you know, listen, if I own a 50-year-old Remington rifle, never had any problems with the trigger. My dad never had any problems with the trigger. I'm now holding on to this gun. I've never had any difficulties with it. You know, and you want me to send my gun to you or give me, like, you know, a hat or something? I mean, there's and I'm going to lose the anonymity that I own this gun, right? And then now somebody's going to have it. And all these guys that hold all these firearms, you know, a large percentage of firearms are held by people who are a little bit concerned about the government finding out they have them because they don't want the government to come and get them. So there's all kinds of reasons for this very small benefit that a firearm owner might just say, not worth my trouble. So why are you not, I mean, why should we draw from your inference that they must not have been reached as opposed to the inference that they just didn't care?
I think how we get to that they haven't been reached is the volume of evidence from nationally recognized notice experts that this notice didn't work.
They're just guessing. They're just guessing.
Well,
they have no idea with the effort made to distribute to the wholesalers who were then instructed to send to every store. These experts who probably have never even shot a gun at a pistol at a range are supposed to say how many people didn't get the notice.
There are certain facts that the district court was not aware of and that were not presented by the settling parties' vendors. That is the click through statistics.
They're in the record.
They're not in the record. The click through statistics of how many people clicked on these banner ads. The statistics of how many people opened emails.
If you're going outside the record on appeal, stop it.
No, these are items that were not provided that were known to media vendors. You know how many people click on a banner ad. You know how many people open an email. These are statistics that are easy to know and that the settling parties vendors chose not to provide the court.
Is evidence about the readership, is it called American Rifleman, whatever the NRA's magazine's called? It was in there.
I believe they had a readership, a number, and they assumed that was the volume of people who would have seen that advertisement.
They
so
people
these are falsified
that
statistics
it, right?
That the district court is relying on. And one point I'd like to make in response to your argument as far as the claims process, that's another thing that we raise in our briefing, is that this claims process is so burdensome. There is no reason that these people had to send back their guns. In other cases that Remington's had, they've allowed local gunsmiths to repair it, and they've been
reimbursed. I thought local gunsmiths couldn't make some of the repairs. I know you're
in here. In this case, they did not allow that. In other cases, they did.
Yeah, but I thought some of the local gun shops can't do it. You think that's not true?
Maybe for the 600 yeah. model rifles.
Yeah, correct.
I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Other cases, you mean Southern of Texas?
In Garza versus the Remington case, Garza, they allowed local gunsmiths.
Yeah, I know, but you used the plural. Were you referring to anything besides Garza?
Just Garza.
Okay. Mr. Shirk.
May it please the court. Your Honor, I'm John Shirk with Shicardi & Bacon, and I represent the defendants in this appeal. And with me today is Kevin Parker, who's going to give the plaintiff's point of view. Before I begin, I'd like to bring to the court's attention the demonstrative that's in the record. It's at SA 1706, and this lays out the structure of the Remington settlement. And it speaks to the
Is age. This in the record? Is that thing you're
it
holding
is.
Up the record?
Yeah.
Where is it? Tell us where it is quickly.
1706.
Thank you. The clerks appreciate it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it really lays out the whole structure of the settlement in a nice way, and it also indicates the age of the guns. That came up, I think, Judge Erickson, in a question you had, some of these guns go back to 1948. So we're talking about a huge sweep of time. And this is a complicated settlement. And to say that the judge mailed it in or had no desire is just not accurate. I mean, Judge Smith worked this case. He agonized over
it. Well, what about ignoring the main expert on this, the main acknowledged experts? The district judge ignored. That's what the other side says.
He's not even in the case. He's an amicus expert.
Filed an affidavit. Yeah. Was the affidavit before the district court?
Their so-called expert, Mr. Hilsey, in my view, he has a backward-looking, anachronistic view of notice. I mean, and it speaks to what Judge Loken said earlier. Times have changed.
He's not a witness in the case, but he filed an amicus brief with the district court?
Affidavit? Yeah.
Did you object to it?
Yes, I think
okay,
we did.
Okay, the district judge let it in or not?
Right. And he was.
I'm sorry, the district judge admitted or not?
He did.
Did he admit the affidavit?
He did.
Okay, so it's in the record. Go ahead.
Right.
So he's not a so-called expert. It's in the record. Go ahead.
He's a so-called expert. And this so-called expert also had the opportunity to stand up and speak in front of Judge Smith, and he declined that opportunity at the final approval hearing, which I think is notable. But in any case, I mean, what he is saying about direct notice by email is antithetical to what the recent jurisprudence says. I mean, Rule 23 has been amended and will go into effect at the end of this year, and it provides expressly for electronic communications when the situation warrants it. That's exactly what we have here. Remington communicates to its customers through its email list. It has a robust email list, which it keeps up. It's got about 800,000 names on it.
But only 93,000 recognized as emails connected to these guns, right?
Not even that many, probably.
I thought you sent email notices to 93,000.
We sent email notices to almost a million people. 93,000 got postcards because for them, the email notices bounced back, and so we sent them postcards in an abundance of caution.
You're right. I read my notes wrong. Go ahead.
The notice effort here was almost unprecedented. We went beyond, way beyond as good as practical, and part of that was demanded by Judge Smith.
Do you believe that the 1 million emails went to people who are definitely in the 7.5 million class?
Some of them, absolutely. I don't know how many because the email.
Did the district judge know how many were and about how many weren't?
No. No one knows. It can't be known. The list we put together was wildly overbroad. But when Judge Smith said, listen, go back to the drawing board, you sent notice out. We have, 2,200 claims after the first round of notice. And that was a due process notice with a reach of 73.7, I believe. He said, do it again. And so we had to step back, class counsel and I, and say, what do we do now? I mean, we did due process notice. The judge is not happy. We need to make him happy. We need to stimulate claims. That's why we went to Signal Interactive Media, and we got them to put together this targeted social media-based notice campaign. Was it innovative? Sure. That's what we wanted. But we didn't stop there. Not only did we do this test case proven notice program, we also we layered on a radio program, which was played in 98% of the markets in this country. But we didn't stop there either. We larded on this email program where we took all our active email names and we drew in from every other source we had. Warranty records that Objector's Counsel brought up, repair records, people that had contacted the company.
Why didn't you use the warranty records?
We did use the warranty records in that connection, but one thing you need to know about the warranty records, I mean, like you said, they're old. There's no indicia that the information that they have on the warranty records is current. The old warranty records that we had for a long, long time, which were pieces of paper, were thrown out a while ago, and they started a new program. But what we have is this active customer list. That's what the company uses to communicate with. But did we bring in the warranty information to the extent we had it when we made this behemoth 1 million-person email list? Sure we did. And we brought everything else in, too, and we deduped that list. And then we sent it out knowing that probably a small fraction of those individuals that got the notice had guns that fell within the class. It was the best we could do. The only targeted list we have of people within our class are the refund purchasers, and that's over here on the right-hand side of my chart in the red. Those are individuals that had a, say, a Walker, they had a gun, say a rifle, a 700, Model 700 with a Walker trigger control, and they decided to replace it with the Walker fire mechanism with an Exmark Pro.
Let me ask you a question, change the subject because time is short.
Right.
The district court recites that of the 2,600 and some, or 22,000 claims initially, claims received, 788 claimed personal injury or property damage. Now, what's the status under the settlement of those persons with that claim and non-responding class members with personal injury or property damage claims?
Those claims are not waived. No one waives a personal injury claim.
Whether you make a claim or don't make a claim.
That's right. That's right. Those stay. What we're doing is we're settling economic loss claims.
Vis-a-vis the Massachusetts amicus.
Yeah, they're wrong about that. Judge Smith, when we first crafted the settlement documents, it was never our intention to include personal injury or property damage claims. We saw no ambiguity. Judge Smith did. He brought it up to us, and he required that we amend the language of the settlement agreement to even more clearly reflect that nothing like that was being...
You don't waive any statute of limitations arguments against that, any statute of limitations defenses, though, in the settlement, right?
We?
Yeah, you, Remington, don't waive, give up.
No, we don't.
You don't. Proceed.
No, we don't. Right. Right. Claims rate. That was touched upon by objector's counsel. Claims rate is not a litmus test for the adequacy of notice.
It's relevant,
or the fairness.
You agree it's relevant?
It's a factor that courts look to, but
so
it is
relevant. You agree it's relevant?
It's not the alpha and omega, Your Honor, at all. And
how long can these claims keep coming in? You heard what I asked the other counsel. I'm confused about
here's
that.
Here's how this sets up. If this court were to approve the settlement, then the period of time passes for the judgment to come final. That's when the period for
18
making
months.
Claims starts, and it's 18 months thereafter. That's right. So we have a good long time.
At least two more years, two or three more years.
Yeah, and let's keep in mind. I mean,
now, they've strolled down to where none are really coming in or not.
Oh, they're coming in.
Okay.
Absolutely. They still continue to come in. And let's
is that
keep
the
in
record
mind,
anywhere other than you and me talking about it?
Yeah, it is. It's in our brief that we filed.
Yeah, but is it in the record? You know, is there some place we can go, like the district court's website or any other place that indicates the status of claims at any relevant time? Because they keep changing every time somebody files a brief, I notice.
They do, and I can tell you as an officer of the court right now, when we filed our original brief for final approval, we had 2,200 claims. At the final approval hearing after the supplemental notice program, we had 19,000 claims. As of now, we have roughly 31,500 claims. Mm-hmm. And let's keep in mind, we haven't even started, you know, the period of claims yet. I mean, there will be certainly press information. I think the reporters in the room right now that will pick this up. And so we expect an absolute uptick in claims. And the company is ready to begin this process. We have inventory on stock. Our claims people are ready to answer questions. Our RARC people who we've trained are ready to fix guns, and we're ready to fix guns back at the facility. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Kevin Parker, appearing on behalf of Ian Pollard, the plaintiff appellee, and the other appellees in this case. The Court has heard extensive argument, but I think the Court's task here is relatively straightforward, and that is to determine whether the District Court clearly abused his discretion in approving this settlement. This Court's jurisprudence from the Marshall case confirms that settlement agreements are presumptively valid, and that the district court's determination is entitled to considerable deference. Now, the Eighth Circuit has developed a four-factor test to be used in evaluating these settlements. And the first and, I think, most important factor is recognized by the court is for the district court to weigh the merits of the plaintiff's case against the terms of the settlement. This case involves plaintiffs in a class who own Remington firearms, various models of them, with a defective trigger mechanism. It's an economic loss case, but it's also a case which presents a public safety problem, a safety problem for the people who own the guns, those who are around people who are using the guns. The result of the defect is an unintentional discharge of the weapon, something everybody everywhere wants to avoid. The settlement goes right to the heart of that complaint. And that's why, as plaintiff's counsel, we think it's a good settlement.
Do the plaintiffs believe every gun has this problem, a percent of them? I'm sorry, I've not looked at your actual allegations, and I know we're beyond that stage. But what's your view of the case on that point?
The plaintiff's view of the case is the way the guns are designed, manufactured, the potential for that is there.
In every one of them?
Yes, yes.
Let's proceed.
And so we want to get that fixed, and what this settlement does is provide a way for that to happen. And that's why it's a good settlement from the plaintiff's standpoint. Now, in the Keel case from 2017, just last year, this court was conducting this very same analysis of in reviewing a class settlement certification, and it upheld the settlement because the outcome of the case was far from certain if the case did not settle, and because there was a substantial benefit to the class. And that's exactly what we have here.
Its rate got up to 3%, right?
Pardon me?
Its settlement claims rate got up to 3%, right?
I think it may have, Your Honor.
Right.
But in terms of substantial benefit of the class and obstacles to the litigation, Judge Smith below went through that very carefully. He outlined some of the statute of limitations issues the plaintiffs in this class would face because of the age of their guns. And he even reasoned that if you take the statutes of limitation into effect, it could reduce the size of the class to about 1 million guns. Just by virtue of time. So that's a substantial obstacle that is now waived for purpose of this settlement to get as many guns fixed as can be fixed within
the class.
It's
waived only as to economic loss, not as to personal injury, right? That's what the other side said.
That's correct, Your Honor. Of course, a personal injury case would arise when the gun misfired and somebody was injured.
Yeah.
So that would start that.
The question is when it happens and when you get sued. But go ahead. We won't pursue that.
And so the court approved this settlement because it overcame the serious limitations issues in the case. And, of course, Remington is defending these vociferously and aggressively. And so they're arguing no defect and no causation. So the court did not abuse its discretion when it approved this settlement. The settlement went right to the heart of the complaint. It's feasible. It can be done. Tens of thousands of guns are getting fixed. Tens of thousands of more, maybe up to hundreds of thousands, we don't know, can be fixed by the end of the 18-month period. And so this is a case, I think it fits directly within the jurisprudence of Keel, within the jurisprudence of Marshall, to approve this case. The trial court engaged in the correct analysis as far as choice of law and everything else. He approved the case because it fixes the problem. And from the plaintiff's standpoint and the class standpoint, we're very happy with the settlement. We think it's excellent, and we think this court should affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Ms. Westcott for rebuttal.
I only have about a minute here, so I'm going to try to touch quickly on a couple points that Mr. Shirk made. One point that struck out to me is that he cannot tell you how many of those emails actually reached class members. I think that's critical here. They don't know. And he said, this is the best we could do. And I don't think that's the correct answer. This is not the best they could do. They left out, for instance, television campaigns. They could have done a stronger internet notice. We're not completely discounting the use of digital media here, but what they did here was not a thorough effort. And that's the problem that we raise, and that's the problem that Mr. Hilsey raises and that digital ad expert Mr. Foe raises in his amicus brief. He also stated that they expect an uptick in claims because this hasn't even started. The notice program is over. They're not expecting to do any more notice. Any notice at this point that class members would get would just be as a result of these proceedings. And I think Judge Smith should have gone with his initial gut reaction when he said the low claims rate demonstrates that this notice program has not been effective.
He said this before the first time or second time?
This is after the first round of notice.
After the first, go ahead.
He said this low
claims... I have a vague recollection of other class action settlement processes resulting in supplemental notices in the middle of the claims period.
And the problem here is that it only went up from 0.1% to 0.3%.
You said the 18 months hadn't started, the notice is all done, and
I don't believe they're doing
since
any.
I did class action litigation.
I don't believe they're sending out any more notices at this point.
No. If something is does not seem right in the midst of the class period, the court has discretion to bring everybody in or be asked to bring everybody in and consider whether more needs to be done. And I think that has happened in probably numerous class action settlement situations.
Sure. And with that, my time is up, and I'd ask that...
Well, I didn't know. I took some of your time.
That's okay.
You got another point you want to
And we just ask that the court reverse the decision of the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been thoroughly briefed and argued, and we will take it under advisement.